Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in the O'Galley section of Melbourne, Florida, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for tours, weddings, and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the Grove Museum in Tallahassee was originally the home of Territorial Governor Richard Keith Call.
It sees a transition from a time period where people are enslaved and being forced to do labor to when Governor Collins lives here, his efforts in the civil rights movement.
We'll discuss evolving warfare tactics in the Second Seminole War.
In Florida, Seminole mobility rested on superior knowledge of the waterways and topography of the area.
And we'll talk about Freedmen's Savings Bank records. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Grove Museum in Tallahassee was built around 1840 as the home of plantation owner and Florida Territorial Governor Richard Keith Call. It's adjacent to the current Florida Governor's Mansion. Historian Larry E. Rivers is author of books including Slavery in Florida, Territorial Days to Emancipation. Rivers explains that before the Civil War ended in 1865, Florida was an agrarian-based society dependent upon the labor of enslaved people.
When you think about the state of Florida in 1865, 45% of the inhabitants in 1865 were enslaved workers. So enslaved workers played a dynamic role in the growth of Florida. This area called Middle Florida, that was the area that stretched from the Apalachicola River on the west all the way to the Suwannee River on the east. This tract of land was the most fertile land for growing up staple crops. And staple crops are generally called cash crops. These are your revenue crops like cotton, tobacco, indigo, rice. And in Middle Florida, the staple crop of choice was cotton.
Richard Keith Call built his plantation and home in Leon County. Call served as the third territorial governor of Florida from 1836 to 1839 and the fifth territorial governor of Florida from 1841 to 1844. Call was a protege of Andrew Jackson. When Florida was named a state in 1845, Call ran for president of the United States, but lost to William Dunn Moseley. Even though Call owned slaves, he was loyal to the Union and argued against the secession of Florida in 1861. Trampas Alderman is executive director of the Grove Museum.
One of the important things about telling the story of the Grove Museum is also here at the Grove Museum is also telling the history and the story of the enslaved peoples that lived here on the property, that helped, that constructed the house behind me, that even made the bricks that you see in the house. The enslaved peoples that worked on the plantation, contributed to the wealth of Richard Keith Call. So it's important that we tell that story as well, that it does not get lost to history.
James M. Denham is professor of history and director of the Lawton Childs Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College. He's the author of several books about antebellum Florida.
Well, the Grove was Richard Keith Call's plantation, or at least his house. We don't really know exactly about how much acreage the Grove consisted of in terms of, well, what were there enslaved people growing things basically within the city limits, but Richard Keith Call's primary economic operation was, of course, on Lake Jackson, and he had thousands of acres out there. And we know that he lived in town. When he was in town, he lived in the Grove, but then, of course, primarily when he was out of politics, particularly, He spent almost all of his time out and out north of town in Lake Jackson. But and the Grove itself is it's very uncanny in that it's almost identical to the place that that Richard Keith Call went often. In fact, he was married there, and that is the Hermitage, which was Andrew Jackson's plantation in Nashville. So he was, I think, kind of determined to create a kind of carbon copy of that here in Florida. And again, very early, one of the first substantial structures in the community, that is residences in the community. And of course, it's still there today, right next to the governor's mansion.
Leroy Collins, the 33rd governor of Florida, also lived in what is now the Grove Museum. In 1932, Collins married Mary Call Darby, great-granddaughter of Richard Keith Call. Collins served as governor of Florida from 1955 to 1961. Although he was politically moderate, Collins is remembered for advancing civil rights in Florida. Trampas Alderman, executive director of the Grove Museum.
So one of the unique things, one of the interesting things about the Grove Museum is it sees a transition from a time period where people are enslaved and being forced to do labor to when Governor Collins lives here, his efforts in the civil rights movement. And so you get the span of the history between those two different aspects.
The Grove Museum has three floors, including a basement.
So the basement of the house contains the offices of Leroy Collins, and that is where we discuss his political career. We also talk about his involvement in civil rights movement and the civil rights movement here in Tallahassee. And we also talk about the history of the enslaved peoples. As I mentioned, the house was built by enslaved peoples. The bricks were made by people that were enslaved. That's one of the key parts that we share when you come to visit the Grove.
The ground floor and second floor exhibits at the Grove Museum focus more on the Call Collins family. Trampas Alderman.
So the first floor and the second floor is dedicated to telling the family's history. There were some interesting members of the family, Richard Keith Call, his daughter, Ellen Call Long. And it was, so if you come, you get to experience the history of the family that lived here, the history of the area, as well as the history of the territorial period and modern Florida as well.
Historian James M. Denham.
One of the things that's happened during my lifetime is the full story of what went on in these places is being discussed, debated, and used, particularly by using primary documents to recreate, for example, the daily life of what it was like to live there, and both for white people and black people, and for people that lived outside the so-called plantation world, poor white people, for example, and others who in some respects relied on the plantations because they were consumers of their labor, and also their produce and so forth. So it's a very complicated story, and it can be a very hurtful story. But of course, it's one of the most interesting things about the Reconstruction period, for example, is how numerous African Americans prevailed, became involved in politics, economic growth.
Most of the buildings associated with Florida's Antebellum Plantation Society no longer exist. A few, like the Grove and the Goodwood Plantation in Tallahassee, operate as museums. Historian Larry Rivers.
Well, I think there is a great value of preserving these plantations as historical sites so that you will know what happened during the antebellum period. And through your primary research, you can get the voices of enslaved people, the voices of those who own those plantations, and you can just see how society developed from a slave society to a society of freedom for enslaved people. They became free men and free women. So I think it's important that we not forget about the antebellum period, because the antebellum period sets up how blacks began to develop or continue to develop their institutions like their churches and their schools. All this started during the institution of slavery, but a lot of it was hidden. But after slavery ended, a lot of these institutions within the black community began to expand. So we need to know about the Grove. We need to know about Goodwood. We need to know about the Bannerman Plantation. We need to know about many of these plantations throughout Middle Florida, because they tell the history of a group of people who helped to make Florida what it is today.
The Grove Museum in Tallahassee is open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about the Florida Historical Society Conference Cruise taking place May 16th through 21st, 2027, with educational presentations, a private historic tour in Nassau, Bahamas, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Second Seminole War is the topic of considerable research among Florida historians. In 1837, the U.S. Army once again found itself stymied as a band of 400 Seminole warriors and their black allies, led by Sam Jones, Alligator, and Wildcat, retreated across Lake Okeechobee. Unable to follow the Seminoles into the Everglades, the superior force of 800 soldiers expressed their all-too-familiar frustration at their inability to fight the Second Seminole War with West Point's European-style training. As Brigadier General Thomas Jessup wrote to Colonel Zachary Taylor, the Army would need to utilize the technologies of the Seminoles if they were ever to succeed in their mission of removal of the tribe to the Oklahoma Territory. Jessup conjectured that adapting the use of canoes to access the lake would enable the Army to complete its mission by winter 1838. Jessup's optimism was misplaced, and the war dragged on for another 5 years. The letter, however, informs us of the frustrations associated with fighting in Florida and the necessity of utilization of indigenous technologies and adaptation to the state's climate and landscape. From the Apalachicola to the Okeechobee, Florida and its indigenous and black defenders challenged everything military strategists knew about warfare.
In a 2016 article, Christine Rizzi, at the time a Ph.D. candidate at the University of Mississippi, placed her article within the extensive historiography of the environmental history of the war and utilized the letters and diaries of officers and ordinary servicemen to, quote, fit the wartime challenges of Florida's landscape into a larger framework of the difficulties Americans faced while encountering new frontier environments, end quote. She argues that, quote, the disparity in environmental knowledge that characterized the Second Seminole War typified a much larger conflict over access that emerged in the 19th century, end quote. In the minds of many, the allure of the frontier and the potential for development justified Seminole removal. But, quote, the painstaking progress of the American military exposed the difficulty of controlling frontier space and people, end quote. Initially, white settlers followed the indigenous routes, but when they began shaping their own travel paths through native spaces, conflict arose. In Florida, Seminole mobility rested on superior knowledge of the waterways and topography of the area. An example of that knowledge in warfare occurred early in the conflict with the Dade Battle of 1835. The successful ambush of the detachment under Major Francis I. Dade occurred because of the ability of the Seminoles to maintain an invisible presence alongside the soldiers. In Alligator's words, quote, "Every warrior was protected by a tree or secured in the high palmettos until jumpers signaled to open fire." As Rizzi explains, Seminole invisibility was deadly.
Invisibility was a powerful tool, but Seminole warriors adapted to the changing conditions that war produced, moving from battles to guerrilla warfare.
Although the Seminoles were able to deploy large numbers of warriors in the early years of the war, while also maintaining their strategy of concealment, by 1838, as the war dragged on, quote, "the piecemeal defeat of Seminole bands, coupled with a negotiated surrender of many of the black Seminoles, decreased the ability to field large forces, making pitched battles no longer feasible," end quote. The last major battle was Okeechobee in 1837. Subsequently, small groups of Seminoles, quote, "concealed themselves in hard-to-reach places to avoid capture and removal. Small raids, guerrilla tactics, and near-constant mobility became the dominant strategy," end quote. The decentralized nature of this strategy reflected the ability of the Seminoles to move through a landscape with greater ease than U.S. forces, making it more difficult to collect them for removal. In addition, promises made by Seminole leaders to come into military camps for removal were easily broken and created distrust of Native intentions, adding to the frustration expressed by American soldiers. As Captain John Rowe Smith wrote to his wife in 1838, he was afraid that the army, quote, "shall not do much more than campaign. The Indians are scattering, I fear," end quote. The Seminoles' ability to move surreptitiously around the landscape and, quote, "go where it was impossible for whites to follow," end quote, supported a white prejudice that posited indigenous people were primitive and could live in places no white settler would consider. Knowledge of the land and the ability to sustain themselves was not hailed as commendable, but evidence of inferiority. Seminole use of mobility and landscape knowledge to their advantage also, quote, "strained their ability to produce crops or maintain food supplies and caused considerable hardship," end quote. Seminole women attempted to farm in concealed areas, but as Lieutenant John Bonnell Marchard reported upon his discovery of a Seminole farm on an island in the Everglades, he, quote, "destroyed everything useful to the Indians," end quote. Destruction of Seminole food supplies became a major goal of the military, a strategy to force surrender and removal.
Connie, to meet the evolving Seminole War, the U.S. military also changed tactics.
Rizzi defines the first year of conflict as particularly grueling, citing Governor Richard Keith Call's expedition along the Withlacoochee River as an example, and referencing one biographer who claimed that the campaign, quote, "met with every hindrance imaginable," end quote. Call failed, Rizzi asserts, for two reasons. He underestimated the difficulties of establishing supply caches on the sparsely settled frontier. Secondly, despite previous experience in the Creek War and in Florida, he was unprepared for the nature of the terrain and length of time needed to traverse it. The Army also struggled with river crossings. Three failed attempts with multiple deaths marked early efforts to cross the Withlacoochee. The Army dealt with its supply and manpower issues by constructing roads through the wilderness and building forts across the landscape. Marshes and swamps plagued the search and removal phases of the war. An 1841 scouting report by W.E. Pima noted that progress was impeded by sickness as the movement of the men largely took place in water and nightly sleep was impeded by swarms of mosquitoes. The efforts of the Navy in the Everglades was hampered by the endless expanse of water and grass. Even after the Navy employed shallow draft flat-bottom boats to pursue the Seminoles, they had little success in overcoming Native resistance to removal. Rizzi concludes, quote, The restrained mobility that typified the U.S. experience during the war weighed heavily on the minds of the soldiers sent to remove the Seminoles. Marching, searching, and fighting were physically exhausting exercises, especially when exacerbated by disease. The monotony of poring over the wilds of Florida also mentally drained U.S. soldiers of all ranks and posed implications for the strength of the American will. The Seminole tribe would be almost completely removed from the territory they fought to call home. Those who the U.S. forced to emigrate encountered a perilous journey to Indian territory. Those who remained kept to the security of the Everglades. Even then, they would have to defend their freedom with a third Seminole War in 1855. Rizzi ends by noting, ultimately, the Second Seminole War slashed the Seminoles' access to the peninsula to a fraction of its original size, all in the name of American pursuit of land, resources, and power.
And yet the Seminole remain undefeated. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. In 1865, at the end of the Civil War, the Freedmen's Savings Bank was established to serve formerly enslaved people in the South, including Florida. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Sarah White is a history PhD student at the University of South Florida. She recently delivered a presentation at the 91st annual meeting of the Southern Historical Association in St. Pete Beach, Florida, titled "Tracing the Transition from Slavery to Freedom in Florida: Depositors at the Freedmen's Savings Bank of Tallahassee." On March 3, 1865, Congress chartered the Freedmen's Bank. Many depositors at the bank assumed that it was legitimized and overseen by the U.S. government, especially considering that Congress authorized the Freedmen's Bureau on the same day it chartered the Freedmen's Bank.
It was not. The Freedmen's Bank was actually overseen by a group of initially all white men who considered this a charitable endeavor, that they were going to help these newly freed people build their savings and teach them about economy and thrift. However, the Freedmen's Bank was strategically pillaged by these white men who were kind of out to enrich themselves. And because it was pillaged this way with these really poor investments that were really just to enrich the board, the bank could not survive. And it eventually, you know, had to be shut down, and depositors lost most of their savings.
Before the Freedmen's Bank collapsed, two branches existed in Florida, one in Jacksonville and the other in Tallahassee. Sarah used surviving records from the Tallahassee branch to create a database that could help us better understand the lives of the formerly enslaved people who deposited at this bank.
I created a spreadsheet based on the Tallahassee Freedmen's Bank records, and what I was aiming to do was to list every depositor who provided both a state of birth and a residence, because I really wanted to look at folks who were located in Florida who had been brought to Florida during slavery. I identified 757 formerly enslaved depositors who opened accounts at the Tallahassee Freedmen's Bank. So of those 757 depositors, you had 41% born in Florida, 16% born in North Carolina, 15% born in Virginia, and then 8% in Georgia, 7% in South Carolina, and 6% from Maryland. So those numbers suggest that you had this significant boom of enslaved people who were brought to Leon County and the surrounding areas from out of state during the generation preceding the one that was made up of emancipated young adults. And you can also see some really interesting trends when you look at ages. So you had 91% of those depositors who provided their ages. And the average depositor at the branch overall was born in 1834. But the average Florida-born depositor at the branch was born in 1844. So they were a full 10 years younger than that branch's average. And it's also possible that such a large percentage of depositors were Florida-born because such a large percentage of them were young. So the folks who deposited at the Tallahassee Freedmen's Bank weren't a randomly selected sample of freed people, because unlike many formerly enslaved people, these folks all had at least a little bit of cash to deposit. So if you were dependent, if you were elderly, if you had any kind of restrictive disability, you probably wouldn't have had cash to open a bank account.
In addition to demographic data, Sarah also gathered occupational data from the Tallahassee branch records.
I was really interested in depositors' occupations and trying to learn more about what everyday life was like for these formerly enslaved Floridians after emancipation. And how were they earning these incomes that allowed them to open these bank accounts? So for the Florida-born depositors, the folks who were born into slavery in Florida, 43% of them reported being in some kind of farming occupation, farmer, farming, planting, something like that. And then 21% reported working in some kind of domestic occupation that could be cooking, washing, ironing, sewing, cleaning, being a house servant. And also among the total group of depositors, there were maybe about 3 to 5% who reported that they were in educated professions like teachers and ministers.
Part of the Freedmen's Bank records include an application form in which depositors shared more information about their lives, deepening our understanding of enslaved people's experiences.
Eliza Kirksey was born in Richmond, Virginia. She didn't know her age in 1871. She had no husband, and she was working as a cook for Mr. Page in Tallahassee. And when she was asked about her children, Eliza said that her daughter Margaret Kirksey was dead. And the surname Kirksey suggests that both Eliza and her daughter likely spent formative years on one of James Kirksey's plantation. He was a major slaveholder in the area. But near the bottom of Eliza Kirksey's application, you have kind of the most shocking detail. Eliza said she has two grandchildren of Mr. Page, a white man, which was presumably the same man for whom she was working as a cook. So it seems that most likely that Margaret Kirksey, Eliza's daughter, was raped or coerced to have sex with Mr. Page while she was enslaved and consequently bore at least two of Mr. Page's children. So Eliza, it's actually kind of stunning that she claims her grandchildren on this bank application. Technically, that was illegal in Florida. She's accusing her employer of a crime, although she doesn't use his first name. But those grandchildren were the only family that Eliza had left. And maybe cooking for Mr. Page was the only way she could see them. So the information recorded on Eliza Kirksey's bank account application is kind of an anomaly. You don't normally have most applicants stating out in the open that their employer raped their daughter. But in that instance, this stands for what was happening everywhere. You know, we know there were countless Margaret Kirkseys throughout Florida and the southern U.S. who were sexually assaulted on a regular basis while enslaved. But we have this remarkable example. The reason we have it is due to the boldness of Margaret's mother, who was defiantly speaking out about Mr. Page's crimes to a bank clerk.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in the O'Galley section of Melbourne, Florida, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for tours, weddings, and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.